Well, that's the problem of evil. The new atheists also like to argue against the immoral commands or atrocities or overall evil in the Bible. So they like to argue against the Old Testament law. They'll say things like, oh, you're really into family values. Well, let me show you what the Bible says about family values. And this can become quite satirical, quite funny. Polygamy, incest, rape, murder. I mean, all the way on down the line. I mean, the lists are endless. And saying, oh, yeah, that's what the Bible teaches about family. Or what does the Bible teach about this or that or the other thing? They're always pointing out, we got all these grotesque, immoral laws in the Old Testament. This is something. If there's one thing you could know, it's these principles. You might not be able to answer every possible scenario in the Old Testament, every possible law that you've studied intently. If you could at least know these principles for interpreting Old Testament law, you would know quite a bit. Here's one argument. For one, what's called the civil law is obsolete. The civil law is obsolete. What do we mean by the civil law? Well, to run a civil government, you need to have laws. Like what happens if, you know, your neighbor's cow comes in and he gores your kid? What's the restitution for that? What happens if you're building a roof? You know, one of the builders falls off your roof and hurts himself or dies. What do you do about that? Well, the Old Testament is filled with civil law. What do you do in a government to take care of certain issues? This is obsolete. In the civil law in the Old Testament, what happened if you weren't circumcised but you wanted to live in Israel? You were thrown out. Yes? Genesis 17:14, God gives Abraham the sign of the covenant. And if anyone doesn't get circumcised, they are cut off, no pun intended, and thrown out from the nation of Israel. In the New Testament, what do we see, however? Just the opposite. Gentiles are allowed in, and they don't need to get the snip in order to be part of the spiritual community. What about false teaching? In the Old Testament, what was the punishment in civil law if you were a false teacher? Capital. Capital punishment. What do we see in the New Testament? When Peter is talking to Simon the magician, he's a magician, a former occult practitioner. What does he do? Does he ask to get the stone so he can kill him? No. He leads him to Christ. What about Paul when he meets Bar-Jesus, which I always just thought was a funny name. Bar-Jesus. Bar-Jesus is trying to turn the authorities against Paul. And Paul, what does he do? Does he say you should be stoned to death? No. He does blind him for a time, which I think is symbolic or illustrative to show that this man who's spiritually blind has now become physically blind. So I think Paul used that miracle for a reason. What about adultery in the Old Testament? What happens if you cheat on your wife, on your husband? What was the punishment? Death. What about in the New Testament? When the man is a mother lover, sleeps with his stepmom, what does Paul do? He quotes the same passages, remove the evil from your midst, citing Leviticus 20, verse 10. But he reinterprets it completely to refer to church discipline, not at all to capital punishment. What about secular government? In the Old Testament, there was a theocracy. In the New Testament, you try to actually just go into all nations, not to take over, but to make disciples. And so the civil law is obsolete. We see this through example, for sure, all the way throughout the New Testament. After the New Covenant is inaugurated, we don't have a civil law. Why? Because we don't have a civil government. We're not supposed to make a nation. We're supposed to go into the nations. Number two, the civil law was the first law, not the final law. This is a little bit controversial, and it might make you tense up a little bit. I'm going to argue that the civil law was not God's ideal. So when you read certain civil laws, now I'm not referring to the Ten Commandments. That's the moral law. I'm referring to the civil law. That when you read the civil law, this wasn't God's ideal, but it was the first law in order to gain some sort of civilization and to give the Israelites some sense in which they were civilized. But it wasn't perfect. After all, how can you create laws that make a perfect society? In 1863, when Abraham Lincoln issued his Emancipation Proclamation, that was a really good law. Did it do anything? No. Why would we think that God giving law, civil law, would create a perfect society? Or that he's even trying to issue perfect laws? It seems to me that God was doing what he could to get what he could at the time, to move along his plan of salvation. Now, that's a pretty big claim. How do you know that's true? I know it's true because Jesus said it's true. In Matthew 19:18, they're debating Deuteronomy 24:1-4 about divorce. And in Deuteronomy 24, you have a case law, a civil law, about how to divorce your wife. And the Pharisees are asking Jesus, are you with Shammai on this? Like really strict? Are you with Hillel? Like really laissez-faire, hands off. How do you interpret Deuteronomy 24 on divorce? And Jesus says neither. They're like, what do you mean? He says, well, because of your hardness of heart. See, when God gave Deuteronomy 24, it wasn't an ideal situation. God doesn't like divorce. In fact, Malachi 2:16 says God hates divorce. He hates it. Yeah, when the two come together, God has put them together. Let no man rip asunder. God hates to see divorce. He says, but because of your hardness of heart, Moses permitted divorce. But from the beginning, it has not been this way. So what's Jesus saying? He's saying there's at least one example of a case law, a civil law, where God permitted it. He didn't command it. He didn't even like it. It wasn't his design for people to get divorced. And why? Why would he do this? Because of the people's hardness of heart. This is the same word used in the Septuagint. I believe it's in Exodus 7, verse 11, to refer to Pharaoh. Pharaoh's hardness of heart. The people were sinful, and piling on a bunch of laws isn't going to change society. But God was getting what he could for the time. Number three, case laws weren't commands. Case laws weren't commands. What do you mean by that? Well, let me show you. Exodus 22:1, atheist website. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, see, the Bible supports stealing. Contradiction. That's a contradiction. That contradicts the seventh commandment. Thou shalt not steal. And yet Exodus 22:1 says you should. Well, does it say you should steal? That says if you steal. Is God pro-stealing? No. If that happens, what do you do? Well, there's restitution. Exodus 21:18. If men have a quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist. See, God is pro-MMA. He's for fighting. No, it's if this happens. He's not for quarreling, for gosh sakes. He's not for it, but if that happens, this is what you're supposed to do. Exodus 21:7. If a man sells his daughter as a female slave. This is on every atheistic website right here. Oh, see, the Bible is for selling your daughter into slavery. Guys, these aren't commands. These are case laws. They're not saying you should do it. These are giving restrictions when people do this. And in fact, if you read the context for Exodus 21:7, it says that she should not be passed around. In fact, the woman has rights to food, to clothing, and to conjugal rights, sex from her husband. An idea so foreign to the ancient Near East at the time that a woman could demand conjugal rights from her husband. So that's the setting here, totally restricting evil. And yet, in the very beginning, it's not even a command. It's a case law. What about Deuteronomy 21:15? If a man has two wives, there you go. The Bible supports polygamy. No, it does not. This is a case law. If that happens, this is what you do in that situation. Does that make sense? Let me give you an example of another one that's particularly egregious, pretty savage. Deuteronomy 21:10, when you go out to battle against your enemies and the Lord your God delivers them into your hands and you take them away captives. You go out to fight, you win, and you get captives. And you see among the captives a beautiful woman and have a desire for her and would take her as a wife. He shall also remove the clothes of her captivity and shall remain in your house and mourn her father and mother a full month, and after that you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. It shall be, if you are not pleased with her, then you shall let her go wherever she wishes. But you shall certainly not sell her for money, and shall not mistreat her because you have humbled her. Bother anybody else? You go out to war. You kill some people, you take them back as captives, you see a particularly beautiful woman, and you say, you're going to be my wife, and I just killed your husband, and you're with me from now on. That bother anybody? These case laws weren't commands. And let me point out that this is radically different from the ancient Near East. For one, this woman wasn't treated like chattel, like property. She wasn't a sex slave. She wasn't raped and thrown away, which was typical of the ancient Near East. They would just use women and throw them out. Number two, she was given 30 days to grieve. So an Israelite soldier couldn't just grab a woman, forcibly have sex with her, assault her, and throw her away. He had to wait a month to let her grieve the loss of her loved ones. And number three, he had to marry her. So marrying her, huh? You know what other cultures did this at the time? None. So, and then it also goes on to say you couldn't just get rid of her when you were done with her. If she wants to, once she leaves, she can do whatever she wishes. And so I hope you can see here a drastic difference. That yeah, when you first look at Deuteronomy 21, you're like, whoa, okay. But first of all, it's a case law. It's not a command. This is trying to restrict evil, not trying to promote evil. And when you compare it to the surrounding cultures, you see that the Old Testament law was way better than the neighbors. Incredibly, incredibly civilized. I like to put it like this. If there's one thing you can remember here, it's this. If I was to live in any nation in the ancient world 3,500 years ago, 3,000 years ago, if I could pick any nation on earth, it would be Old Testament Israel. They had the most dignified laws of any other culture on planet earth. Unbelievable. Now, the Hebrew law focused on two things. It came in real strong on this. The faith of Israel. Because if the faith of Israel was off, this would lead to idolatry. This would lead to immorality. This would lead to taking apart basically the foundations of the nation. So the faith of Israel. And that's why you see, why are false teachers killed? Because that would disrupt the faith of Israel. And then the family. The family unit was highly protected. The one who argues this really well is John Wenham in his 1974 book, The Goodness of God. That book was an absolute tour de force. He's a British scholar, and he went through and showed just how defensible of a position it is to defend the goodness of God with regard to the Old Testament, New Testament, hell, problem of evil, and everything else. But he really focuses on this, which makes a certain amount of sense to me. Makes you wonder, you know, in that culture, they really valued a family unit. So if you committed adultery, you were killed. Like, that's how you show in a culture, like, what you really value. If you're going to kill a person over something, do capital punishment. That means you really value what the person did. And so adultery would rip apart a family, right? That's interesting. See, in our culture, if I came into your house and broke in late at night and I stole your big screen TV, they would throw me in prison. But if I came into your house and stole away your wife and committed an adulterous affair with her, that would completely ruin the husband's life. That would completely ruin the kids' lives. That would completely rip apart the family. And in our culture, there is no punishment at all for that. So it really causes you to pause. I can steal a guy's wife and there's no punishment. I can steal his TV and I get 5 years in jail. Well, it really makes you wonder. God really puts a high level on the faith in the family as being very important. Call Pope Pan, that's so funny. Paul Copan is a Christian philosopher out of Florida. He says, Hammurabi demanded the death penalty for those helping runaway slaves. Middle Assyrian laws punished not a rapist, but a rapist's wife, and even allowed her to be gang raped. Think about that. So a rapist would go out and rape, and he wasn't punished, but his wife was. In other ancient Near Eastern laws, men could freely whip their wives, pull out their hair, mutilate their ears, or strike them. A dramatic contrast to Israel's laws, which gave no such permission. So true. It's night and day different. And finally, number five, is it that we know too much or know too little about these laws? I would argue that we know too little. We're literally dealing with laws which were written 3,500 years ago. So why is it in Leviticus 12 you can't boil the calf in its mother's milk? I've got an article on it. I've got some answers for it, but if you really depress me, I don't have a clue. Why is it that you can't mix this with that? Why is it that, I don't know, because we're dealing with a culture that is over three millennia removed from us. It's funny, when we go across the country, like I remember going over to Cambodia, and while I was over there, so this is modern day, 21st century, I went over to Cambodia, and over there, they're very, very physically affectionate. The men, very affectionate. Made me a little bit uncomfortable, honestly. They were so affectionate. We went to take a picture at the end of our time there. My buddy and I were teaching expositorially through the pastoral epistles. And all of the Khmer came over and we'd become friends with them that week. And we're all just, group hugging. We're going to take a big picture. And one of the guys there I was particularly close with, I really loved him a lot. And he put his hand on my shoulder. And then we were taking the picture. I was smiling. And then he put it on my back. And then he kind of put it on my lower back. And I kind of stiffened up a little bit. I'm like, that's not... And then he just put his hand right on my butt cheek. And I would pay money to have that picture. Like, I would love to see the look on my face to have that picture. I don't know what I looked like, but it must have just been like, And in that culture, that's how they are. Very touchy-feely, very affectionate. And I'm not for it. I'm not saying I want to incorporate that over here. But what I'm saying is, in different cultures, they have different standards. And very often, it isn't that they're disagreeing with us morally. It's the expression of these different moral values. What about lex talionis? And you're like, why is there a big eyeball up there? This is eye for an eye. Lex is Latin for law. Talionis is retaliation. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Was it Gandhi who said, if you do eye for an eye, the whole world is blind? Is that a true quote? I don't know if it is. I wonder. Anyways, it's all over the internet, so I guess it's true. The law of retaliation. A lot of people look at this and say this was ancient barbarism at its worst, that it's tit for tat, it's just no mercy, no grace. Where's the grace? Where's the forgiveness? Where's the rehabilitation? No. You take one from me, I take one from you. Well, for one, this isn't literal. Leviticus 19:18 tells us it's not literal. The Jews were not to, quote, take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people. But, and here are some classic words, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So how about that? That almost sounds like somebody I know. Jesus, I think he said that. You're not supposed to take vengeance. Now, this is in the book of Leviticus. This is in the Pentateuch, the same place that we get lex talionis. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. In fact, this is only five or six chapters away from Leviticus 24, which teaches the same thing. So how can it not be literal? This context shows that it isn't literal. For example, Exodus 21, 26 says that if a servant was injured, they could go free. In verse 30, a ransom was given for damage. So in the very context where we find lex talionis, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, you have a servant getting injured, and he doesn't go up to the man he's working for. Really, the word servant is ebed, servant, slave, it's translated. But he could go up to the man he was working for, and he didn't say, okay, I want one of your eyes too. Instead, he's just released. He goes free. And in verse 30, he would have to be paid depending on the injury. So let me explain how this would go. You're my buddy on the construction site in ancient Israel. We're building a house, let's say. We're working together, swinging a hammer, and you're not paying attention. You come back and pull the hammer back too far, and you hit my eye, and it becomes infected, and they operate on it. By operate, I mean take a flint knife and pluck it out. And now I lost my eye. Now I'm wearing an eye patch. I turn to you and I say, what are you going to do about this? And you're like, well, how about I give you restitution? How's $50 sound? And I'm like, no, I want your eye. Give me your eye. And you're like, no. How about $500? And I'm like, no, I'll take your eye. Until finally you're like, okay, how about $5,000? And I'm like, all right, deal. That's worth it. Was I really there to try and get your eye? What do I need with the eye? The point is, it's going to be judicious. That if you took something from me, you're going to have to pay a ransom. Exodus 21:30, to pay it off. So in other words, what we're saying here is this was created for protection, not for revenge, not for vengeance. Protection specifically for the poor. So the poor weren't marginalized and so forth, but rather they were protected. That if somebody was rich, came through and hurt them, they would say, yeah, I want an eye for an eye on that, until the rich paid up what it was worth. By contrast, the code of Hammurabi practiced this differently, and yet it was different. Aristocrats were exempt. So if an aristocrat plucked out somebody's eye by accident, they didn't have to pay anything. And if you were a builder and you messed up on the roof and the roof caved in and killed the person, the builder's children were killed. So Deuteronomy 24 says that if you're a builder and you mess up the roof and you're negligent and it kills the guy's kid, you're held responsible. Hammurabi actually had the builder's kid killed. How's that for justice? That's literally eye for an eye. What about slavery in the Bible? A lot of people say, oh, the Bible's just a book of slavery. Smith and Hoffman, from their book, What the Bible Really Says, Prometheus Press, this is an atheistic publisher, they say the New Testament, like the Old, not only tolerated chattel slavery, chattel meaning property, treating people like property, but it actually helped to perpetuate it by making the slaves obedient to their masters and making this a religious duty. So the New Testament was so evil, so wicked, that basically it encouraged slaves to submit. They write, this biblical morality was one of the greatest handicaps that the emancipation movement in the United States had to overcome. So I got so many things to say. I better not get ahead of myself here. I will get ahead of myself. Who started the emancipation movement in the United States and Britain? Evangelical Christians. William Wilberforce in Britain, and Mennonites and everyone else over here. It was a Christian movement. It's so unbelievable that they would say this. This is not an academic press. This is an atheistic publisher. Anyways, okay. Does the Bible endorse slavery? Let's start with the Old Testament. What does the Bible say about slavery in the Old Testament? Number one, slavery, if you could call it that. This could be a case where we're using the same vocabulary but different dictionaries. We're thinking slavery like chattel slavery, like slavery in the United States, in the South. Is that what we're thinking? No, this is more like servitude. Perhaps even indentured servitude would be the best way to describe it. As I said before, the word ebed in Hebrew. You know who's called an ebed? Moses. He's called an ebed of God in the Old Testament. This is not referring to slavery like we think about it in the U.S. So slavery was voluntary because a person went into poverty. What do you do in a culture where you can't go bankrupt? You can't file for bankruptcy. They would basically say, well, if you're in poverty, you can sell yourself as a servant and work for someone who has money and basically make your way that way. Deuteronomy 15 is an incredible passage which says the debts were forgiven every 7 years. What this means is that if you fell into bankruptcy and you were going poor, you couldn't feed your family, that every 7 years your land was returned, the year of Jubilee, and everything was wiped out. Whoa, wouldn't that be so cool in our culture? Then you wouldn't have this cyclical problem of poverty being passed down one to another, but all the property lines would go back and everyone would start at zero again. So you'd have capitalism, where if you were, you know, very prudent and you're wise and a businessman, you could get ahead and you could buy other people's property and you could make a lot of money. And yet after the year of Jubilee, all those property lines went right back to where they were. And people who were poor would get their land back and they could provide for their families. Leviticus 19 verse 10 says that the poor were allowed to harvest free food. So this wasn't a handout, as they say, but the farmers were told, you may not go through and pluck every last piece of produce. You got to leave some for the poor. Number four, the poor weren't charged interest on loans. Exodus 22:25. Whoa! Think about that. The poor. So, okay, they were selling themselves as servants in a house because they went to poverty. And yet you could get a loan and there was no usury. There was no interest. You think about urban areas today where you go through and you see houses boarded up, poverty, and then you see check cashing places on every street corner. So evil, so wicked. Why are they always in poor neighborhoods? Because the poor can't get ahead. And so they say, yeah, we'll cash your check a little bit early, but we're going to take 25%. Talk about ripping off the poor. In this culture, you could not charge interest. Kidnapping for the purpose of slavery or anything else was a capital crime. Exodus 21:16. How about that? So if you kidnapped a person and then put him into slavery, you were killed according to the law. Number six, you were commanded to harbor runaway slaves. Deuteronomy 23:15. Why? The text tells us because you too were once slaves in Egypt. Number seven, injured slaves were released, as we already saw, Exodus 21:26, and abusive masters were punished. So to call this slavery in the sense of slavery in the South before the Civil War, these could just not be any more different whatsoever. In fact, I would argue that if the antebellum South applied these biblical principles, it would have virtually abolished slavery in the United States. Like pre-war South, antebellum South. Like, if you had it, kidnapping was a capital crime. You could not have any kidnapped slaves taken from Africa and brought over to the United States. So international slave trade, gone. You're commanded to harbor runaway slaves. If we had that in the United States, if injured slaves had to be released and abusive masters were punished, if they came over from Africa and they were freed every 7 years and they were given free food and they weren't charged interest on loans, if they had practiced these, it would have gotten rid of slavery. So this is an example where they weren't applying the Bible too much. They were applying the Bible too little. How about that? Well, there's various examples in the Old Testament which also condemn slavery. What about New Testament slavery? This is different. Again, this isn't a society. This isn't a culture or a nation state. The New Testament church was, you know, basically trying to get out into the Roman Empire and across the world. And in the Roman Empire, you'll read stats that anywhere from one-third to one-half of the Roman Empire were slaves. So much so that slaves wanted to be able to put some kind of a marker on themselves to demonstrate that they were slaves. And the aristocracy, the bourgeois, they forbid it because they were afraid if slaves could see how many slaves were out there in the Roman populace, they would have an immediate slave revolt. Because slaves would realize, why, we're half the population. We could totally get rid of anyone who's trying to oppress us. And so when we read commands in the Bible about slavery in the New Testament, this needs to be read in light of its context. Slavery was a norm. Like, think about it like this. Mark Twain's book, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. It's really funny. Evangelical Christians put this on the do not read list. A banned book. You can't read this book. And then on the other side, you got the politically correct people that are like, you can't read Huckleberry Finn. Why? Because there's a character in the book referred to as N-word Jim. And so to modern sensibilities, you're like, oh my God, Mark Twain, how could you be so racist to have a character with that name? And of course, we would never let our children read that today. Did you know that when Mark Twain wrote this book, it was not considered a racist book? It was considered a progressive book, a wildly liberal book. You know why? Because a young white boy, Huckleberry Finn, had a friend who was a black man named Jim. So in their context, this was a progressive book that people were saying, I can't believe a white boy would be friends with a black man. But in our culture, interpreting it through our lens, we say that's an incredibly racist book. So when we read the New Testament, we have to see it in its context. In the New Testament world, slavery was just a given. Diogenes Laertes said this. He said, there was a man he was once scourging at his whipping a slave whom he had detected in theft. He caught him stealing. And when he said to him, it was fated that I should steal. That's the slave speaking. The slave master rejoined, yes, and that you should be beaten. Why are you a slave? Because of fate. Why am I the slave master beating you? Because of fate. That's just the way the world is. And the New Testament is speaking into this cultural milieu, this cultural background. And it's actually surprising what we read. Paul calls kidnappers lawless and rebellious, 1 Timothy 1:9. The New Testament not only promoted and taught unequivocally equality, but it also taught freedom. 1 Corinthians 7:21, it said, if you can get your freedom, take it. The problem is most of them couldn't. Now, in first century Roman slavery, you could buy your way out of slavery. That was true. At the same time, most couldn't save up. And Paul was saying, if you can get your freedom, take it. But if you can't, stay in the condition in which you were called. There's neither slave nor free, Jew nor Greek. We're all one in Christ Jesus. Jesus, he came to free those who were enslaved. Luke 4:18, those who were prisoners. So yes, Jesus taught this. Yes, the Bible teaches it. And yet, what do we have here? Why would they refuse to just outright say we got to get rid of slavery? Because if they did this, this would have completely ruined the Christian movement. There were slave revolts. Every single one of them was met with complete annihilation. Think of Spartacus. Spartacus led a slave revolt, and it ended with thousands of crucifixions for all of the of those who revolted against Rome. If the Bible taught to revolt against slavery, it would have completely snuffed out the Christian movement. Whereas what we saw in return was that by teaching the gospel and teaching the equality of all people, this lit the slow fuse that eventually brought down slavery. And in fact, we have documents that the Romans were afraid of Christians because they were putting the slaves and the rich people and the Jews and the Greeks and the men and the women all in the same room, and they all called each other brother. And that freaked out the Romans to think, oh, here we have these slaves who are considered people. What about the conquest of Canaan? Yeah, Richard Dawkins, he refers to this. He, in his book, The God Delusion, he says, the Bible story of Joshua's destruction of Jericho is morally indistinguishable from Hitler's invasion of Poland or Saddam Hussein's massacres of the Kurds and the Marsh Arabs. This is the Canaanite genocide, where the Bible teaches that God commanded the Jewish people to come in and to murder, to kill men, women, boys, girls, even the animals, utterly destroy. Put them under the ban, is what it says. Kill. What do you do with that? Well, a number of points can be made here. Number one, the Canaanites were a massively sadistic and depraved culture. No question about it. We see this in the Bible, in the holiness codes of Leviticus 18 to 20. It explains the sins of the people that lived in Canaan. And God says, and I'll kick you out of the land if you do the same thing. But archaeology has even told us more. Here's Clay Jones. He writes, Molech was a Canaanite underworld deity represented as an upright bull-headed idol with a human body in whose belly was stoked and in whose outstretched arms a child was placed that would be burned to death. They would heat up the stomach and heat up basically a cauldron until you had the hands of Molech being held out, and then they would put their babies on his hands to sizzle. Jones says, it wasn't just infants, it was children as old as four that were sacrificed. A bronze image of Kronos was set up among them, stretching out its cupped hands with a bronze cauldron which would burn the children. As the flame burning the child surrounded the body, the limbs would shrivel up and the mouth would appear to grin as if laughing until it was shrunk enough to slip into the cauldron. Modern archaeology has found these, and accompanying these are a number of little tiny bones of babies and children all the way up to age 4. Well, what we're saying here is that the Canaanites weren't judged because of their genes. This is not genocide. This is not a racial genocide. They were judged because of their practices. This is very clear. I mean, even if we didn't have the science of archaeology, it's in Leviticus 18, 20 to 30, what they were doing, child sacrifice, all sorts of horrendous things. This is what we would refer to as a corporate capital punishment. Now, I know some people aren't very keen on capital punishment, but let me just argue this. If there was a reason for capital punishment, even if you don't believe in it, if there was a reason, do you think that reason would be something on par with burning your child as an infant, like burning them alive? Do you think that would qualify? I think it would, even if you don't believe in capital punishment. I think that would, like if you found out that your next door neighbor was putting their kid into the oven and turning it on and just letting their kid sizzle, that's the kind of thing that would qualify for capital punishment if that's morally plausible. And the same thing is true here. It's a corporate capital punishment of the people. And again, it isn't based on their race, the Canaanites. It's based on their practices. Deuteronomy 9:4, it says, after the Lord your God has brought you into this land and done this for you, do not say in your hearts, the Lord has given us this land because we're such a good people. He says, no, it is because of the wickedness of the other nations that he is pushing them out of your way. Deuteronomy 9, good verse to remember. It's not that they were so good, it's that the Canaanites were so evil. Number two, this is the only approved offensive war in the Old Testament. And you might say, well, wait a minute. David did a bunch of wars and there's these kind of wars. Yeah. There's war all throughout the Old Testament. This is the only one that was commanded. Number three, the Canaanites were given 400 years to change their practices. Now, maybe some people would say, well, what if they're just given 450 years, 500 years? See, after 400 years, it seems to me that you are pretty much settled into what you're doing and you're not going to change. In fact, Abraham was talking to God about this, and God said in Genesis 15, 13, your descendants will be strangers in a foreign land where they will be oppressed as slaves for 400 years. That's the Exodus. Why would God's own people languish in slavery under a dictator who is committing infanticide and chattel slavery? Why would he allow this for 400 years? He says in verse 16, your descendants will return here to this land, for the sins of the Amorites do not yet warrant their destruction. Why are the people going to be in slavery for four centuries? Because the Canaanites, the Amorites, were one of the seven tribes in Canaan. Their sins haven't yet reached to warrant their destruction, or the iniquity of the Amorites has not yet been fulfilled. We see, too, that Deuteronomy 9:1 and Exodus 23:27 says that the people are going to be dispossessed or driven out. This is interesting to consider on a number of levels. This is the same language used of the Assyrians in 722 and the Babylonians in 586-87, dispossessing the Jews and driving out the Jews and the Israelites. Now, does this mean that all of the Jews and the Israelites were annihilated, like there were no Jews? Well, of course not. But many were driven out of their land and they were dispossessed. What this means to me is that people who heard about the coming of the Israelites, like Rahab, Joshua 2, we've heard about you. We heard about the Exodus. We've trembled with fear. The people who got out of Canaan, out of Israel, they took off. They were dispossessed and driven out. The people who stayed behind to fight were a hardcore, unrepentant remnant. Like a hardcore, we know that you're powerful, but we refuse to leave. And we refuse to change. Now, that being said, I'd like to give you a theory that is held by a number of Old Testament scholars which is this, that Joshua, the book of Joshua, may be using hyperbolic language. You know what hyperbole is? That's like saying, I'm so hungry I could eat a horse. Really? Like you're so hungry you could eat a 900-pound animal? Well, no, it's hyperbolic. It's exaggeration for the sake of effect. When we read Joshua 10:40, Joshua struck all the land. He left no survivor, but he utterly destroyed all who breathed. How many different ways could you put it? All, no survivor, utter destruction. Just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. When? To Moses. Deuteronomy. He commanded utter destruction. They're put underneath the ban. So God had commanded this, and it says that Joshua fulfilled it. All the land, no survivor, utter destruction, all who breathed. Joshua 11:16, Joshua took all that land. Yet, two chapters later, we read that there were still people in the land. What do you do with that? Is that a Bible contradiction? That in chapter 10 and 11, it says that all of them were annihilated, and then chapter 13, it says that they're there? Is it a later redactor who came in and didn't get his sources right? Obviously, we reject both of those firmly. If you believe in the inspiration and the inerrancy of Scripture, what do you do with that? They're all killed, and yet they're not all killed. It could be that this language isn't meant to imply complete annihilation. Think about it like this. Deuteronomy 4:26, Moses says that in the future, the Israelites will be utterly destroyed. Is that true? No. They're still Jews today. And in this context, we read that actually God's going to regather the Jews. So are they utterly destroyed or not utterly destroyed? It must be that we're not reading this through the lens of the original author's intent. That utter destruction doesn't mean universal annihilation. We see the same thing in Judges. Judges 1:21, the Canaanites persisted in living in that land. The Canaanites, the Benjaminites, or Jebusites, Judges 1:28, they did not drive the Jebusites out completely. And so they were completely driven out just as God commanded, and yet at the same time they're still there. What about with Saul? 1 Samuel 15:3, go and strike Amalek, the Amalekites, and utterly destroy all that he has. Do not spare him. Put to death both man and woman and child and infant. And so, verse 8, Saul utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. Now, if that's not universal, I don't know what is, right? And yet, I don't know, 13 chapters later, we read that David was still fighting the Amalekites. Chapter 28. So which is it? Were they completely annihilated, man, woman, boy, girl, infant? Or is this hyperbolic language? As if to say, go in there, kill them all. Kill every single person from the first to the last, highest to the lowest. Or is it just saying, go in there and win. Go in there and fight. You're a military man. Win the war. Paul Copan points out that this is an example that was frequently used in the surrounding cultures of war rhetoric. So this isn't meant to be taken literally. That's his point. This is used in Egypt by the Hittites, Thutmose III, Ramses II, the Merneptah Stela, the Assyrians, the Sennacherib, where they're always saying, we wiped him out, we wiped him off the face of the earth, and then we find out later, no, not really. Now, the problem with, if this is all we had, I would feel very uncomfortable. Because the Egyptians lied. They lied a lot. When you read the different grave inscriptions and tomb, they lied constantly. You know who else lied? The Hittites. Yeah, the Merneptah Stela. Basically, these old ancient Near Eastern governments would write things to make themselves look good. So if this is all we had, I would say, no, I can't accept that. Just because other nations used lies in their war rhetoric, that doesn't justify us thinking that the Israelites used lies or that God lied. What I'm saying is that the text itself implies that this is hyperbole. And when we look outside of our text, we see a similar use of language when it came to war rhetoric. Does that make sense? Now, am I planting my flag on that and saying I'm 100% sure? No. But I'm opening up the door. I'm saying there is room to think that this is hyperbole based on the fact that these texts appear to contradict. It could be that we are not grasping the authorial intent. The real question here is, does God have the right to judge? If your answer to this is no, then no explanation would satisfy you. If your answer to this is yes, in reality, God shortening a life from 80 years down to 40, in the scheme of things, isn't really changing anything. Even in the case of kids, to take the life of a child, we usually say when a doctor does something, he's playing God. What do we mean by that? We mean that he's saving or taking a life. Does God have the right to play God? Does God have the right to take a life? If you believe, like me, that babies and infants and little kids are underneath the age of accountability, then you'd have to believe that these kids, even if they were, if this is not hyperbole, if they were taken early and judged, that they were taken right into heaven. Only the morally responsible agents, therefore, would be judged. And if you got a problem with God's judgment, you're going to have a real problem when he returns, because apparently this is just a foretaste. When he comes to judge unrepentant people who refuse to turn to him, he's coming back. He's going to do the same thing. And it's not going to be just for Canaan. It's going to be for the entire globe. And God does have the right to judge. And there's really not much more to say about it than that.